you say, well, the police, obviously, you obviously want your 100% faith in someone, you trust them, don't you, really? And stuff like that, obviously, yeah, there's no excuse, there's no for that, is there, really? You can't excuse that at all.
I think it's horrendous. And what's probably worse is they shared it and other people looked at them and presumably quite enjoyed them, and it's awful.
I think they should get fired. That's definitely confidential, so they shouldn't be sharing that. Yeah.
That's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Now, I work for the NHS and we see some difficult things at work, and it's gross misconduct if you share any information about your patients or any images, and I would expect the police to behave in exactly the same way. And to have a WhatsApp group, it's just terrible.
You wouldn't expect that from police officers. They're meant to be there to keep you safe, so that just really angers me whenever I hear that. Yeah.
First I've heard of it, but it obviously sounds wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just inherently think that's wrong just as a person, not a policeman or otherwise. Just as a human, you wouldn't do that, would you?
At the scene of a crime, that's terrible. I don't think any private thing should be taken or shared. It's police material should not be shared with the public.
I think that's very, very, very bad and very unrespectful towards the woman, but also the family towards this woman.
I think that's definitely sort of part over the line as such, definitely not professional and shouldn't happen, really.
I don't know the details of that particular incident, but if that was done without consideration of their privacy or was not part of some kind of formal release of investigation, then I think there's probably some wrongdoing there.
I think it's a boundary that has been crossed. I don't think that that's the right thing to do.
Just not having any clue of the feelings of the families or all people. You're dealing with this traumatic event and you just don't have the compassion to understand how traumatic this is for everyone. If you're taking photos and being a tourist about it, we're kind of losing the point of being a person.
Social media is probably 90% of the problem. And I think anybody that uses that platform to accentuate any crime or reveal and share is rather disturbed, to be honest.
A London police officer has been jailed for life for raping and murdering a woman called Sarah Everard. How is it that a murderer was able to serve in the police? Here's the public's opinion.
Perhaps, there needs to be tightened regulations or a re-evaluation of how, we select the police. Or
they should obviously have to go up against a platform where there's some kind of, control or procedure that's put in place like it was in the old days in the United Kingdom.
I guess, you never know who the bad guy is until something happens.
It got through the loophole somehow because, I presume they do checks. Some things weren't picked up, so something's gone wrong there. I mean, there are bad people in all walks of society.
Maybe they just didn't do enough background checks on him before he went into the police force. Maybe they need to get more, tighter on security checks on who's going into the police.
How would anyone know that someone is going to do that, right? And you can only run a criminal background check on someone if they've been convicted of a crime. So if they've been suspected and weren't indicted on it, weren't convicted of it, then there's no record of it.
I wonder the same thing. But then also rapists and murderers are also a bit everywhere. It's just sad that they're also in the police force because you think, if I want to be police, I'm a good person and should follow the law. And also leads to more scariness because why should I trust the police if they also murder me? And like that.
Yeah, how do they? I wouldn't be best to answer that. I'm sure they get vetted before they start the role, but it's not nice. But it could happen in any profession, I suppose. But yeah, again, it's you'd expect it not to happen in the police, but these things do happen, unfortunately.
Well, there's obviously a lot of police personnel, so anyone can get in, really. Again, it's down to the individual. I wouldn't say that's them as a whole, and to say it is them as a whole is completely wrong, in my opinion.
It's a very sad news, and I think it puts the entire police on a very bad spot.
Well, I don't think, say, mental illness or those type of issues they have no bounds. It doesn't matter what your career is or how intelligent you are.
I should think the vetting process needs to be more studied and more thorough when they either at recruiting stage or progressively through their life.
Here are the facts. The London Metropolitan Police employs almost 33,000 officers in the front line to try and keep law and order in a city with a population of around 10 million people. Yet, since 2005, 26 Met officers were convicted of sex crimes, 27 of theft, and 72 were convicted of violence against other people. Has public confidence been affected by these latest convictions? A poll in October 2021 revealed 63% of those polled trusted the police in general, but only 33% trusted the Metropolitan Police. In the same poll, 31% said they did not trust the police in general, but that lack of trust rises to 43% for the London Metropolitan Police, meaning that more people distrust the London Met than trust them.
Given all these recent revelations, what level of trust do the people here in London feel able to give their police force?
Ooh, that's a loaded question.
Would you make a call and feel safe, or?
I would make a call. Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to trust that the government is working.
You would go to them, but not perhaps one on his own.
Yes.
You'd want two.
Difficult to say, because I think the Londoners have come to accept it. Visitors, depending on where they come from, might find it strange to have that sort of police force in somewhere like civilised world like the UK.
I think anywhere in the world that stuff happens. Like, the police and the government's corrupt anywhere.
It's an isolated incident, and I would say 99.9% of police officers are doing the job for the right reason. You can't tar them all with the same brush.
I do still trust the police because that was one person, but, yeah, it's just, it makes it quite difficult, you know, to trust them after hearing that.
How many policemen are there in London, policemen or women? I'd say this is a very, very small minority, surely, of the force as a whole, in which case I'd be likely to trust them.
Not really so much trust, because, like, when I see them or, like, when they're around the area, I want to feel like, OK, safe, they're here. But if I know that they also do this and that it happens often, of course I don't feel safe around them.
To be honest, not very much, unfortunately. I have here 2 years, and to be honest, I don't have seen much effort from the police to do their best to protect their people, the residents here.
Just because, you know, that's what you see in the news and the paper, so that's the sort of front face of the police, is the negative stuff. I do think the police do a lot of positive as well that doesn't necessarily get reported on.
Well, the fact that if it's been confirmed that someone like that has been serving in our police, and it, particularly if it's been known for a while and action hasn't been taken, then it reduces our trust.
There's a lot of crime in the police force happening, so I think it's hard to say 100% yes.
Well, I guess you do somewhat not. It does reduce your trust.
You know, you have these kind of incidents all over the world, and I don't think London policing or the police force in the United Kingdom should be held to blame for an incident like that.
Well, that's not fair to lump all the police together, so I think there's still trust in the London police.
Looking at the situation from an international perspective, what image does this police behaviour generate to the wider world about the way law and order is carried out in the capital of the United Kingdom?
I guess you just got to be cautious. It scares people, like, not to be able to trust the police officers.
I mean, I've come to London this weekend, these few days to visit, and I was walking around late last night. I probably feel safer here than I do in my own home, if I'm honest, because there's lots of people around, and, it feels busy and it's well lit.
It did make me quite scared because I lived in London during the pandemic and I heard about that girl getting murdered. So it just makes you think, like, is it good? Is the security here good, you know, in London? And, like, as a girl, do you feel safe walking home at night when you're hearing that? Yeah. So I'd say it just does scare you a bit.
Those examples obviously aren't good, but in general, I'd surely say that the police are doing a good job.
I think it scares everybody, really. And I mean, as a tourist myself, I don't really feel so safe walking around here when the police is doing this.
I don't think we should be preaching to internationally to any country, to be honest. We should look closer to home first before we start preaching out, should I say, so to speak.
Well, information now travels very, very fast in nowadays, and you know, immediately everybody will know in the other countries, so, and everybody talks about it, and for sure it can it does damage to the image of the police here in Great Britain. Absolutely.
I definitely think it'll have a negative effect. You know, it's sort of the first impressions, isn't it? If that's sort of the first you hear about British police or English police, and it's a negative story, then that sets it up for the future. And
I think it projects an image that this not being correctly managed at the highest levels, and more needs to be done. And I imagine that other nations looking in would wonder, well, if you're allowing that to happen, what else are you allowing to happen too? And therefore breeding greater distrust overall, not only for our own police services, but perhaps breeding mistrust in other aspects of our public services.
I think that it's really sad, and it puts a bad image on the London police.
I think it is a real eye-opener.
It is definitely going to affect, because the people coming from other countries are definitely going to think wrongly.
Whether they break the law themselves, they need to be reprimanded, or whether they're carrying out the law, they need to serve and protect with the utmost integrity and respect for the public as well, because that is their vow and the pledge that they take.
A catalogue of offences uncovered by investigations and confirmed in court has served to keep London's police force in the media for all the wrong reasons. While the UK has previously criticised other countries for their failures in law and order, London's own police force appears a case study in offences admittedly by a small number of individuals, but nevertheless, these cases have undermined the credibility of the force. And some would say it's authority to preach to other countries about enforcement standards.
Revelations and court cases against members of the London Police have damaged confidence in the force. These have also raised questions about the public's level of trust in the police in London. Now, most police do an excellent, honest and difficult job. However, public opinion suggests that trust, which takes a long time to build, can be quickly lost. It is a substantial challenge for the Metropolitan Police to win back what it has lost in terms of that public confidence and, some would say, its international reputation due to the illegal actions of an irresponsible, violent and even murdering few members of the force.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The condition of the Shia movement, which was a movement led by the Imams, a movement in the political sense, is an activity, an organized activity against the authority, to overthrow an authority, a regime, and to establish a new government. One of the things we see, just to give us an example so we can understand a little better perhaps, a contemporary example of a movement that was similar in many ways. In fact, it was the continuation of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. Using the methods and the tactics of the Ahlul Bayt was the movement of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini spoke against the regime with provocative language and took stances against the regime. Others would decide that it's better if we speak in a softer tone. Imam Khomeini deliberately. That tone of Imam Khomeini rallied up and gave courage to a good number of people, gave them the energy. They had the ideological foundations. They knew what was happening was wrong, but they didn't have the motivation to come forward. When they see that leader speaking in that way, they came forward. With that, Imam Khomeini was imprisoned, the initial stages of it. Imprisonment, if he would stand strong in prison, which he did, and getting that data out, that will encourage more people to come forward, which it did. And it forced the government to have to release him. After they released him, Imam Khomeini continued and took more firm stances against the regime. They sent him to exile. In exile, he continued those strong stances. And this led to more and more people getting empowered, getting encouraged, gaining courage, learning from the sacrifice of the leader to sacrifice. This was what Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, did during his time. And we've got to learn that. This is where it connects to us today. Brothers, sisters, we are at a very important period in the history of mankind. We are living at a time where the majority of the people of the world understand that the elite of the world are corrupt and they're causing injustice. The time where people lived in faraway places, disconnected, they didn't know of the crimes in this region and that region. They were preoccupied with their own local matters in such a way where they didn't have access to. That's all long gone. The people throughout the world understand that the conditions that we're living in are unjust. Governments are unjust. The world elite are unjust. They understand all of that. The courage to come out and stand against these governments, it comes about here and there. You see outrage by people. You see them pouring out on the streets in different countries. In France, it's been, I don't know how many years now it's been. It's been over a year. I know that, but I don't know if it's 2 years yet or not. Every Saturday they were coming out. In the Muslim world, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Yemen, in Arabia, they call Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, you have people coming out. You have conditions like this. In the U.S., we had the riots, if we can call them that, which in at least some cities they were, the protests, the outrage of the people against the atrocities of the state, of the government. But it's short-lived. Generally, even in those cases, if you look, the numbers of people, they're not too many. They're not enough. They're not enough. In order to get more and more people to have the courage to stand, to rise, we as followers of the Ahlul Bayt have got to take a lead on this. Under the guidance of the Ahlul Bayt, under the guidance of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi. We need to speak more clearly against the injustice. We need to speak more openly about how this injustice needs to come to an end. The people need to rise and overthrow these regimes. We need to be very explicit, very open, very using very strong anti-establishment language that Imam al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi used. He provoked the regime to imprison him and then stood strong in prison. We've got to do the same. Whether we get imprisoned or we don't know what's going to happen. Not all the companions of Imam al-Kadhim were imprisoned either. Some were, some weren't. But we hope that we resemble Imam al-Kadhim. How is it that we call ourselves the Shia of Imam al-Kadhim? He was imprisoned and we're not. How can we be the followers of an Imam who spoke against the authorities in ways that caused them to not only imprison him, but to torture him? We call ourselves his followers and we're not willing to do that? At times where there are similarities and we do have this taklif, let them imprison us and let us stand strong in prison and let them kill us. That will only hasten the coming of the Imam. That will only hasten the overthrow of these tyrannies. That will only hasten the gathering of larger numbers in support of the overthrow of these regimes and the establishment of the government of justice. It will show the direction, as the Quran says, the Ahlul Bayt have said, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, learning from those two sources, said that the shuhada will be the lanterns, the beacons that will guide others. Let them imprison us. Let them torture us. Let them kill us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make us beacons that will shed light in the darkness of this world and guide masses. And we will see, inshallah, the Imam of our time, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, soon. It is soon, inshallah. It is soon. We hope that we are like those who have engaged in this in the different parts of the world, the likes of Sheikh Zakzaki that has engaged in this. The imprisonment of Sheikh Zakzaki, inshallah, with him standing firm, is going to encourage more people throughout the globe, as we have seen it has. This is continuing the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, establishing them today. And inshallah, we will become part of that. May Allah bless the souls of those who did that, who were imprisoned, who were tortured, who died in torture, who became shuhada under torture. Whatever other taklif they had, and they became shuhada. And we hope that we have the tawfiq to join them, inshallah. Sallallahu alayk, ya Aba al-Hasan, ya Musa ibn Ja'far. Let's take our hearts to call the main.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف
Majid, Majid, Majid. صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We were talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khomeini, and I'm going to ask you about what we left off, in fact, Sheikh Tawid, in the last episode about the invalidating agents for the prayer. To my recollection, you have enumerated five of those invalidating agents. Would you please continue to the sixth and to the last one, please?
As you rightly mentioned, we're talking about those things which make a prayer void. And of course, the sixth thing which invalidates prayers is to talk even by uttering, for example, a single word consisting of one or single letter which has a meaning or denotes something. For example, I think, as far as I remember, we have discussed this in one of the previous episodes, but we are now discussing the invalidating agents in more detail, of course. So we cannot utter a single unrelated word in prayer, even if it has a meaning, something good, something positive. It doesn't make, it doesn't mean, or it doesn't become a license for us to say it in prayer. Okay, yes. And we, of course, let me just say it very clearly that we have no right whatsoever to add anything to the prayer what is not a part of the prayer. So, for example, to recite a zikr or to include a dua, for example, to recite a zikr which is highly recommended to read out of the prayer, we cannot add to the prayer what is not a part of the prayer. And the prayer has fixed, you know, zikr. That zikr that has been prescribed by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, the Holy Prophet said to us, Sallu kama ra'aytumuni usalli, okay?
Right.
Offer your prayers in the same way as I offer, okay? Do not add to the prayer anything which is not part of the prayer. Otherwise, it's called bid'ah. So we cannot, you know, include something which is alien to the prayer and which is not related to the prayer.
Like folding the arms, for example.
Now, for example, folding the arms, of course, talking and like saying a single word, like, for example, qay. I think qay means to protect yourself.
Yes.
So if we just utter this word deliberately and intentionally, the prayer becomes white. But of course, if we just say something unforgetfully or, you know, erroneously or unintentionally, the prayer is not made white because we did not intend in the first place to say it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you please talk about the seventh?
Yeah, the seventh, of course. The seventh thing which makes the prayer void is to laugh loudly, to, you know, intentional loud laugh.
If someone, laughter.
And if the laugh or the guffawing is uncontrollable or involuntary, and of course, if what prompted it in the first place was intentional, it makes the prayer void. The prayer is definitely affected. But okay, if one laughs loudly or unintentionally, or if he you know, loves without, you know, without emitting any voice, you know, there is no problem. Sometimes you might laugh and you might start giggling, but there is no voice, okay? No voice is heard. That, because it does not produce any sound,
mm-hmm.
you are laughing in your heart somehow.
Yeah. Yes.
So that will not affect your prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the eighth invalidating agent. As, you know, if one intentionally weeps, you know, silently or loudly over something worldly, something, let's say, mundane, you know, his prayer becomes void, you know. But if a person weeps silently or loudly due to the fear of Allah or for the hereafter because of, you know, a divine or a heavenly matter,
mm-hmm.
there's no harm, because we do see that some scholars, some great scholars, you know, I have myself seen many scholars who weep in their prayers, and it's quite audible, you know, they weep in their prayers. It's not because of worldly reasons or because of earthly or mundane reasons. They weep during prayer because of fear of Allah and
yes.
because of extreme taqwa. They have reached a level of taqwa where when they offer their prayers, they find themselves guilty, and they think that they have not observed, they have not offered their prayers in the way which Allah deserves, and they did not worship Allah in the way He deserves. Of course, we can never worship Allah in a deserving manner. So that's why many scholars weep, and that kind of weeping does mm-hmm. not affect the prayer.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back again and continue our program of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio related to prayers according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker in the studio. We are talking about the laws related to prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And more specifically, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the invalidating agents, and you have reached eighth.
Yeah, I think I have reached the ninth one.
Yes.
The ninth one.
Okay.
The ninth invalidating agent is when a person offers his prayer, and he does, while offering prayer, actions like clapping or jumping up and down, you know, because it's necessary for a person offering prayers to keep his body steady, motionless, and of course he cannot do anything which deforms or which actually takes the prayer out of the recognized mode, you know. For example, if a person starts clapping or jumping, this will definitely invalidate his prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether he does it intentionally or forgetfully, because he goes out of the form of prayer. The form of prayer is not maintained.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But, you know, there is no problem in actions which do not change the form of prayer. Like, for example, making a brief sign with one's hand, like pointing to something. For example, if you are offering prayer and you just point to someone, to a family member, okay, to turn on the light, or let's say to turn off the stove, okay?
Right.
It doesn't make the prayer void, okay? It's a small action that does not change the form of the prayer. And, of course, the tenth invalidating agent is eating and drinking. We do know that no one can eat and drink while offering prayer. And if a person offering prayer eats or drinks in such a manner that people would not say that he was actually offering prayer or that he was in the state of prayer, his prayer would definitely become void, regardless of whether he does it intentionally or unintentionally. eating and drinking under any circumstances will definitely cause the prayer to become wide.
Sheikh Javed, when you say eating, you know, sometimes it happens to people that, you know, even after brushing their teeth, some particles of the food still remain in their mouth.
Sure.
So if you're in a state of the prayer and then you feel there is a particle in your, for example, mouth, can you still swallow it?
You're right.
Would that be considered as eating?
You know, in common view, that's not considered to be eating. You know, no one is going to tell you. Because I did mention if someone is calling, someone considers you as being busy eating something or drinking something,
right,
then it makes the prayer wider. Okay, if you have a small particular food or food particle in your mouth and you swallow it, it does not affect your prayer.
I see.
There are two more invalidating agents left.
Yes.
I would like to, squeeze in these two,
I appreciate it.
Invalidating agents. And of course, any doubt concerning the number of rakas in the prayer, which consists of, for example, two rakas or three rakas, we discussed to some extent, elaborated on the issue of doubts and said that if a person doubts between one or two rakat while he's offering two rakat prayer, or while he is offering a three rakat prayer like the Maghrib prayer, and he doubts whether he offered two rakat or three rakat of prayer, or one rakat or two rakat, then, of course, his prayer becomes wide. And, of course, if a person, adds an extra rukun, for example, he performs one more ruku, one more ruku, or he performs two more sajdas in the prayer, which are considered to be rukun of the prayer. Adding one rukun or deleting or omitting one rukun from the prayer will definitely make the prayer wide. And this is, of course, the 12th invalidating agent. So the 11th was to make a doubt, which makes the prayer wide. And, of course, the discussion concerning the doubts is lengthy.
Yes.
And then adding or omitting a rukun from the prayer, which definitely makes the prayer wide.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice elaboration of the invalidating agents for the prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight.
The answer is simple. The U.S. military establishment does not care. The Pentagon and its higher ops have continuously failed to prioritize the health and safety of military members and their families, says Liz Walters Ryder in an article published under the heading $770 billion for the U.S. military, poisoned water for military families. Stay tuned for more. Concerns from hundreds of military families living on the joint naval base Pearl Harbor Hickam in Hawaii about foul-smelling drinking water were dismissed on November 29, 2021 by Naval Commander Captain Eric Spitzer. who assured residents the water was safe to drink. Spitzer declared that he and his staff were drinking the water, so surely reports of a gasoline-like odor, cramps, and vomiting were nothing to worry about. Then, less than a week later, on December 5th, Spitzer took to Facebook to issue an apology. What had happened in the days between initial denials of water contamination and the issuing of the apology? As it turns out, the companies of nearly 1,000 military and civilian households weren't unfounded. Rather, a November 20th jet fuel spill at a fuel storage facility near the base had leaked into the water supply, rendering the tap water of 93,000 residents, both military families and civilians, hazardous to drink. Tested samples from the Red Hill water shaft, one of the three sources of water for the base, contained total petroleum hydrocarbons diesel range organic, 350 times the levels considered safe for drinking water. Tests also showed gasoline range organics at more than 66 times the safe level. In short, despite the base commander's assurance on November 28 that the water on the base was totally safe to drink, it was indeed contaminated with petroleum and jet fuel. Just 2 days later, on November 30, the state health department urged families to avoid using tap water for drinking, cooking, or oral hygiene. While Hawaii Department of Health warned residents on the base against using the water, the Navy continued to deny any danger. Behind the scenes, however, the Navy had halted the use of Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility and took its Red Hill Water well offline on November 27th and 28th without disclosing either decision to residents. In a December 2nd press release, the Navy admitted the Red Hill well had tested positive for petroleum but insisted the levels were too low to be deemed dangerous. On December 5th, the day Spitzer took to Facebook to apologize for encouraging families to drink the tainted water, a town hall was held on the base where concerned parents, pregnant women, and nursing mothers spoke from their hearts to Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro. After apologizing for the anxiety caused by the leak, Del Toro stated, "My promise to you is we don't just leave here and forget about you." A day later, Governor David Icke and the Department of Health issued an emergency order directing the Navy to further suspend operations of the Red Hill storage tank facility until independent evaluators could prove that appropriate actions were being taken to protect drinking water. They also ordered the Navy to treat toxic drinking water and plan to remove the fuel. The Navy, however, despite Del Toro's apology and promise to take care of the military families and civilians affected, contested this order, arguing that the suspension of the Red Hill fuel facility would negatively impact naval operations. Since then, the Hawaiian government and Department of Health have been pleading with the Department of Defense to drain the tanks before another disaster affects the people of Hawaii. The Navy has still not budged. Despite orders from Hawaii Congressional Delegation, the Honolulu City Council, and a 13-hour Health Department hearing after which a state hearing officer called the Red Hill facility a metaphorical ticking time bomb, this effort to protect the people of Hawaii from their military occupiers is not new. Hawaii Sierra Club and other local environmental organizations have been protesting the use of the Red Hill facility for years, concerns that another leak was inevitable are not unfounded. The facility experienced leaks in January 2014, March 2020, and May 2021, and these are just the leaks the Navy has acknowledged. In the time since the 2014 incidents, the Navy has done little with its increasingly bloated budget to address the clear problems at the fuel facility instead of considering, for example, the gradual moving of fuel to another location not directly above Oho's water supply, the Navy has used its power to keep its precious fuel where it is, despite the threat posed to its own members, their families, and the citizens of Hawaii. The catastrophic history of Red Hill and the Navy's stubborn resistance to pleas for greater protection of residents of the area raise questions about the role of the military in the lives of ordinary citizens in the land in which military units have inserted themselves. How can the military possess such exorbitant wealth and power yet not respect and protect the most basic human rights, safe drinking water, for the very people responsible for their functioning? How could the Navy allow its own service people, their families, and civilians on the base to consume poison for days, knowing full well that a jet fuel leak had taken place above the water supply on November 20th? Why is the U.S. Department of Defense fighting tooth and nail to guard its fuel instead of prioritizing the health of its service members, their families, and the people of Hawaii? The answer is simple. The military establishment does not care. The Pentagon and its higher ups have continuously failed to prioritize the health and safety of military members and their families. The Red Hill disaster is just one more example of the U.S. Department of Defense disregard for human lives when those lives get in the way of their expensive, deadly operations. Does this disregard make you as angry as it should?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
دوستی اهل بیت آثار زیادی تو زندگی ما داره.
Befriending the Ahlul Bayt has many positive effects in our lives. As we read in Ziyara Jamaatul Kabira, the friendship with the Imams affects the quality of our salat and servitude to Allah. Also, loving the Imams multiplies the blessings and bounties of Allah for us.
محبت اهل بیت یعنی دوست داشتن آدمای خوب.
Loving the Ahlul Bayt means to love the best men of Allah on earth. It also means to disconnect with the enemies of the Imams. The concept can also be seen in tawalli and tabari towards the Imams too. Tawalli and tabari means to love the Imams and to dissociate oneself from their enemies. These deeds will benefit us very much in life. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.